Hello, everyone. We're continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. Last time we did verses 7 through 9, verse 7 and 8. For every kind of beasts and of birds and of serpents and things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed of mankind. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil and full of deadly poison. And verse 9, therewith we bless God, even the Father, and therewith we curse men that are made after the similitude of God. And that's where we left off last time. Lord willing, we're going to continue on here. So the next verse is verse 10. I'll go ahead and read that. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. He amplifies the absurdity by a repetition or new proposal of it. His meekness is observable. He might have reproved them sharply, but dissuading them from the evils of the tongue, he would himself give them a pattern of modesty and gentleness. And now he goes through the words here. These things ought not to be so. That is, they should be quite otherwise. It is a phrase savoring of apostolical meekness. Paul used it in most alike case, 1 Timothy 5:13, speaking things they ought not, in Titus 1, verse 11, teaching things which they ought not. Now, out of this verse, observe, observation one, that blessings and cursing do not become the same mouth. It's not becoming to it. This is like him in Aesop that blew hot and cold with the same breath, I guess an Aesop fable. A good man should be uniform and constant. The same heart cannot be occupied by God and the devil, nor the same tongue be employed to such different uses. The Pharisee prayed and censured at the same time, Luke 18, verse 10. And many pray and curse, pray and rail in the same breath. This is most unseemly. One part condemns and destroys the other. The good aggravates the evil, and the evil disproves the good. Railing is the worse because of the solemnity of the action, and praying is but a revengeful eructation when thus managed and accompanied. When the tongue is employed in prayer, it is as it were hallowed and consecrated, and therefore must not be alienated to common and vile purposes. They were carnal wretches that said, our tongues are our own, Psalm 12, verse 4. Yours is given up to God, which it should be. Now, observation 2, from that ought not to be, we must look not to what we desire to do, but what ought to be done. Lust, or the bent of the spirit, is not the rule of duty. Many advise with no other counselor but their own hearts. Carnal constraints are an ill warrant. Beasts are led by strength of instinct and natural impulse. Man is to be governed by an outward rule. There is a higher Lord, capital L, than your own will. Look then, not to the earnestness of your motions, but the regularity of them or being regulated, not at what you would, but what at you ought or should do. That's the end of verse 10, actually, so we'll go on to 11 and 12. Doth a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine, figs? So can no fountain yield both salt water and fresh. Now here are several illustrations taken from the course of nature to show that one cause and original can have but one orderly and kindly birth. He reasons from what is impossible in nature to what is absurd in manners. In the similitudes, he speaks of what falls out for the most part, or what usually happens. If any rare instances can be brought to the contrary, it prejudices not the apostle's scope, which is to show what falls out in the wonted or often course and influence of causes, and thereby to declare how incorruptible with true religion the evils of the tongue are, if not restrained. His observation, nature abhors hypocrisy and double dealing. Contrary effects from the same cause are monstrous. It is against the whole ordination of God among the creatures. There is not a surer note of hypocrisy than deformity of effects and practices. It is true a Christian has a double principle, flesh and spirit, but not a double heart. All the productions of the soul are like the yeanlings of Laban's sheep, Genesis 30:39, speckled and spotted. But in a hypocrite's life, there is an utter dissonancy and disproportion. Hate this double dealing when you profess religion and live in sins. See how contrary it is to the whole course of nature. Say, sure, this cannot come from a uniform and good heart. Especially use these illustrations to check the deformities of your speech when you are apt to bless and curse, pray and revile. Say, this would be monstrous in nature. Is there such another cause in the world as the tongue is, of such different uses and employments? And that's the end of verse 11 and 12. We'll go on to verse 13. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. He now diverts to another matter, though that which is near of kin with the former, which is an exhortation to meekness as opposed to envy and strife. Who is a wise man among you and endued with knowledge? Some apply this, as all the former discourse, to the ministry, as if the meaning of the question or supposition were, if any be qualified for this dispensation, and they are strengthened in this conceit by the words here used, which hold forth the two gifts that are necessary for ministry. The apostle elsewhere calls them the word of knowledge and the word of wisdom, 1 Corinthians 12, verse 8, but the very structure of the words shows them to be generally intended. He speaks of wisdom and knowledge because all the former evils come from a presumption of greater skill and ability than others, or because they affected the repute of prudent, knowing Christians. Now, says the apostle, if you would be so indeed, you must be meekly godly. The questionary proposal intimates the rare contemporization of these two qualities. Wisdom and knowledge are very seldom coupled. Knowledge, he might grant these censors to be, the people who are being censorious to people, but not wise. And then the next words of the verse, let him show out of good conversation. Now, usually conversation is behavior of life. I believe it can include your speech, but more often is generally your behavior. So let him show of a good conversation. The first requisite of true wisdom is to honor knowledge with practice, how you behave, that being the end of all information or the purpose of it, and the knowing person having a greater obligation to duty than others. The next words, his works with meekness of wisdom. Here is the second requisite, prudent meekness in converse, wisdom being most able to consider of frailties and to bridle anger. The points are these. Observation 1, wisdom and knowledge do well together, the one to inform, the other to direct. They are elsewhere coupled, Hosea 14:9, who is wise and he shall understand these things, prudent and he shall know them. There is a difference between these two, knowledge and wisdom, wisdom and prudence, as appears by that in Proverbs 8:13, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. A good apprehension and a good judgment make a complete Christian. Where heavenly wisdom is, there will be also prudence, a practical application of our light to the occurrences of life, and where God gives knowledge, he gives also wholesome and needful counsels for the ordering of the conversation or behavior. Prudence dispenses the light of knowledge according to particular occasions. Faith is opposed to folly as well as ignorance, Luke 24, O ye fools and slow of heart to believe. Faith is a wise grace, a spiritual prudence more for practical inferences than nice speculations. Well then, do not rest in a form of knowledge, Romans 2 verse 20, couple it with wisdom. A Christian is better known by his life than his discourse. Bare knowledge puffeth up, 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1, gets into the head or tongue, then it is right when wisdom entereth into thy heart, etc., Proverbs 2, verse 10. Men of abstracted conceits and sublime speculations are but wise fools, like the lark that soars high, peering and peering, but falls into the net of the fowler. Knowledge without wisdom may be soon discerned. It is usually curious and censorious. Observation two, that true wisdom ends in good conversation or behavior. Surely the practical Christian is the most wise. In others, knowledge is but like a jewel in a toad's head. Deuteronomy 4, verse 6, keep these statutes, for this is your wisdom. This is saving knowledge, and the other is but curious. What greater folly than for learned men to be disputing of heaven and religion, and others less knowing to surprise it? This is like him that gazed upon the moon but fell into the pit. One property of true wisdom is to be able to manage and carry on our work and business. Therefore, none is so wise as they that walk circumspectly, Ephesians 5:15. The careless Christian is the greatest fool. He is heedless of his main business. Another part of wisdom is to prevent danger, and the greater the danger, the more caution should we use. Certainly, then, there is no fool like the sinning fool that ventures his soul at every cast and runs blindfold upon the greatest hazard. I might enlarge myself in all points of wisdom, but I forget the laws of this exercise. The footnote says, see Dr. Sibbes in Hosea 14, verse 8. The use of all is to check those that please themselves in a false wisdom. Number one, the worldly wise. Men are cunning to spin a web of vanity and to effectuate their carnal purposes. Alas, this is the greatest folly, Jeremiah 8, verse 9. Since they have rejected the word of God, what wisdom is in them? Who would dig for iron with mattocks of gold? The strength of your spirits, your serious cares, are better worth than vanity. Usually providence makes fools of the worldly wise. Their understanding undoeth them, as it is said of Babylon, Isaiah 47, verse 10, they overwrit and outreach themselves. Number two, such as content themselves with human knowledge, some can almost, with Beringer dispute De Omnis Scibili, I don't know what that is, or with Solomon, unravel nature from the cedar of to the hyssop, but know not God, know not themselves. Like the foolish virgins, make no provision for the time to come, and so do but wisely go to hell. Some of the heathens had large endowments, but professing themselves wise, they became fools. Romans 1, verse 22. Number three, such as hunt after notions and sublime speculations, knowing only that they may know. A poor soul that looks heavenward has more true wisdom than all the great rabbis of the world. The testimonies of the Lord make wise the simple, Psalm 19, verse 7. And in another place, a good understanding have all they that do thereafter. Others may have sharper wits, but they have more savory apprehensions, as blunt irons, if heated, pierce deeper than those that are sharp and edged in cold. Number four, such as are sinfully crafty have wit enough to brew wickedness. Oh, it is better be a fool in that craft. 1 Corinthians 14:20, be not children in understanding, but in malice be ye children. Happy they whose souls never enter into sin's secrets. Romans 16:19, I would have you wise in that which is good and simple in that which is evil. It is best be one of the devil's fools, simple as to wicked enterprise. They that affect the glory of acuteness in sin do but resemble their father the devil, who is of great knowledge but much malice. So it's better to be simply evil than smart evil, Not that evil's good, but it's worse to be smart in your evil. Like the devil is, who has great knowledge but much malice. Observation three, the more true wisdom, the more meek. Wise men are less angry and more humble. Number one, less angry. There is much spoken of fool's wrath. Proverbs 17, verse 3. A stone is heavy and the sand is weighty, and a fool's wrath is heavier than them both. He wants or lacks judgment and understanding to allay and moderate the rage of it, so that where it falls with the whole strength and weight of it. The more wisdom a man has, the more can he give check to passion. They can oppose wise considerations, the frailties of nature, their own slips, their need of pardon from God. At least they will not trust such a furious passion and let it out without restraint. Proverbs 19:11, a wise man deferreth his anger, lest it burn with too hot a flame. Once more we hear of the wrath of a fool. Proverbs 17:12, let a bear, it's like the animal, robbed of her whelps, meet a man rather than a fool in his folly. That is, in the heat of his rage, as the similitude implies. And it is called folly, for then men are most foolish. So that was number one, they're less angry. Number two, they are more humble. Proverbs 11, verse 2, with the lowly there is wisdom. Pride and folly always go together, and so do lowliness and wisdom. The world many times looks upon meekness as folly, but it is heavenly wisdom. Moses is renowned in Scripture for wisdom and meekness. Men that are but morally wise, we see, are most meek. And I think he means that are not just morally wise. The laden clusters will bow the head. Well then, we all affect the repute of wisdom, discover it in meekness, in bearing with others, in being lowly within yourselves. Other wisdom may serve your carnal ends or purposes best, but this is true wisdom. This pleases God best. The ornament of a meek and quiet spirit is a thing of great price in the eyes of the Lord, 1 Peter 3, verse 4. The world counts it an effeminate softness. God counts it an ornament. This, the best Christian temper. Christ is the lion of the tribe of Judah, but that is to his enemies. He is a lamb to his followers. Fierce, ruffianly spirits, do not become Christianity, no more than the wolves would the lamb's bosom. There are excellent fruits of meekness that discover the use of it, either in setting on doctrine, man is won by love, with meekness instruct those that oppose themselves, 2 Timothy 2:25. This is like the small rain upon the tender grass, or in preventing contention, a soft answer pacifieth strife, Abigail stopped David's fury, etc. Observation four, meekness must be a wise meekness. It is said, meekness of wisdom. It not only notes the cause of it, but the quality of it. It must be such as is opposite to fierceness, not to zeal. The Spirit, the Holy Spirit, appeared in cloven tongues of fire, as well as in the form of a dove. And the apostle said, there is a spirit of love and power, which may well consist and stand together, 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. And observation 5, from that let him show forth, a Christian must not only have a good heart, but a good life, and in his conversation, his behavior of life, show forth the graces of his spirit, of the Spirit of God, Matthew 5, 16, let your light shine, etc. We must study to honor God and honor our profession. It is one thing to do works that may be seen, and another to do them that they might see your good works. It does not note the scope, but the event. And that is the end of verse 13, and we'll go on to verse 14. But if ye have bitter envying and strife in our hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. So having showed what was the effect and token of true wisdom, he infers that if the contrary were found in them, they had little cause to glory, rather to be ashamed, and opposes two things to the former double effect of wisdom, to meekness and good works. He opposes envy and strife. The words of the verse, if ye have, the apostle's modesty in reproving is observable. He does not positively tax them, but speaks by way of supposition. So in chapter 1, 25, and chapter 2, verse 15, in reproofs, it is wiser to proceed by way of supposition than direct accusation. The next words, ye have bitter envying. He notes the root of tongue evils. We pretend zeal and justice, but the true cause is envy. He calls it bitter envying to distinguish it from that holy emulation, which makes us strive to strive who shall excel each other in the ways of godliness, as also from true zeal in God's glory, which they pretended, as if he had said, it is a zeal, but a bitter zeal. As also to note the original of it, it proceeds from the overflow of gall and choler, I guess like choleric, some disease, that root of bitterness that is in the heart. It also notes the effects of it. It is bitter to ourselves and others. It makes us displeasant to those with whom we do converse, and though it be sweet for the present, yet when conscience is opened and we taste the fruits of it, it proves bitterness in the issue. And it shows whither that similitude in verse 11 tends, doth a fountain at the same time send forth sweet water and bitter. The next words, and strife in your hearts. This is the usual effect of envy. And he says, in your hearts, because though it be managed with the tongue or hand, it is first contrived in the heart, and because this aggravates the matter. Breaches may fall out between Christians in their converse besides intention, but where they are affected and cherished, they are abominable. The next words, glory not, that is, either of your Christianity, an evil so contrary to it being allowed, or of your zeal, it being so deeply culpable, or of any special wisdom and ability, as if able to reprove others, this most probably. For the main bent of the discourse is against opinionative wisdom. You have no reason to boast of your wit and zeal in censoring or contention, as men are wont or often to do in such cases, unless you will glory in your own shame. Rather, you have cause to be humbled, that you may not get these vile affections mortified. In the next words, and lie not against the truth. Some say by our carnal profession, hypocrisy is a practical lie. Some speak lies, others do them. John 3:21, he that doth the truth cometh to the light, etc. Rather by false pretenses of zeal and wisdom. It is a phionasm usual to the apostles' writings. Romans 9 verse 1, I say the truth in Christ, I lie not. And 1 John 1 6, we lie and do not the truth. Now out of this verse observe, observation number one, that envy is the mother of strife. They are often coupled, Romans 1 29, full of envying, and that follows murder and debate. So Romans 13, 13, not in strife and envying. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 3, there is among you envying, strife, and factions. So 2 Corinthians 12, verse 20, envyings, wraths, strifes. In Galatians 5, 20, emulations, wraths, strifes, and seditions. These things being so solemnly coupled in Scripture intimate to us that envy is but a cockatrice egg that soon brings forth strife. The world had an early experience of it in Cain and Abel, and afterwards in Abraham and Lot's herdsmen, then in Joseph and his brethren, Genesis 37, 4, they envied Joseph and could not speak peaceably to him. In verse 11, they envied him, and they conspired to slay him. And so in Saul and David, 1 Samuel 18, verse 9, he eyed David ever afterward, so also in the priests against Christ, for envy they delivered him, Matthew 27:18. There are two sins which were Christ's sorest enemies, covetousness and envy. Covetousness sold Christ, and envy delivered him. These two sins are still enemies to Christian profession. Covetousness makes us to sell religion, and envy to persecute it. The church has had a sad experience of it. It is the source of all heresies. Arius envied Peter of Alexandria, and thence, or from that, those bitter strifes and persecutions. It must needs be so. It must be so. Envy is an eager desire of our own fame and a maligning of that which others have. It is compounded of carnal desire and carnal grief. Well then, let nothing be done through strife and vainglory, Philippians 2 verse 3. Scorn to act out of that impulse. Should we harbor that corruption which betrayed Christ, enkindled the world, and poisoned the church? Observation 2, from that strife in your hearts, there is nothing in the life but what was first in the heart, Matthew 15, 19. Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, blasphemies, thefts, adulteries. There is the source of sin and the fountain of folly. As the seeds of the creatures were in the chaos, so of all sins in the heart. Well then, look to the heart. Keep that clean if you would have the life free from disorder and distemper, Proverbs 4, 23. Keep thy heart above all keeping, for out of it are the issues of life. The Jews were banished from England for poisoning fountains. The heart is the fountain. Keep it clean and pure. Be as careful to avoid guilt as shame. If you would have the life holy before men, let the heart be pure before God. Especially cleanse the heart from strife and envy. Strife in the heart is worst. The words are not so abominable in God's eyes as the will and purpose. Strife is in the heart when it is kept and cherished there, and anger is soured into malice, and malice bewrays itself by debates or desires of revenge. Clamor is not or nothing, but malice is worse. The apostle forbids clamor or the loudness of speech, Ephesians 4:31. But woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds, Malachi 2 verse 1. Studied wickedness is worst of all. Observation 3, envious or contentious persons have little reason to glory in their engagements. Envy argues either a nullity or a poverty of grace. A nullity where it reigns, a weakness where it is resisted, but not overcome. They that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the lusts and affections thereof, Galatians 5:24. He is a carnal man that is carried away with any inordinate affection or lust, again generally being a corrupt desire of the heart. Now, of all lusts or these corrupt desires, this is the most natural. The spirit that is in us lusteth to envy, James 4, verse 5. Children betray it first. I saw, said Augustine, a little child looking pale with envy. As it is natural, so it is odious. It is injurious to God and his dispensations, as if he had unequally distributed his gifts. It is hurtful to others. We malign the good that is in them, thence hatred and persecution. It is painful to ourselves, therefore called the rottenness of the bones, Proverbs 14, verse 30. In short, it arises from pride, it is carried out in covetousness and evil desire, and ends in discontent. Oh, then, beware of this bitter envying and strife, Ephesians 4, 31. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger be put away from you. It is hateful to God, prejudicial to others, troublesome to ourselves. It is its own punishment. Nothing more unjust than envy, and yet nothing more just, says Nazianzen. Will you know what it is? Discontentedness at another man's good and prosperous estate, holiness esteem, renown, parts, etc. He suggests that's what that is. In carnal things, it is sordid. In higher things, it is devilish. In the one, we partake with the beasts who ravenously seek to take the prey, P-R-E-Y, from one another. In the other, with the devils and evil angels who, being fallen from happiness, now malign and envy those that enjoy it. Envy discovers itself, number one, by grief at others' enjoyments, Genesis 4. Cain is sad because Abel's sacrifice was accepted. Their having is not the cause of our want or lack, but our envying it. Number two, in rejoicing at their evils, disgrace and ruin, Psalm 22:7, they laughed me to scorn, this is he, etc. David fasted for an enemy's fullness, etc. Number three, by incommunication, men would have all things enclosed within their line and pale, are vexed at the commonest of gifts, because they would shine alone. Moses, contrarily, said, "Would to God did all did prophesy." Numbers 11:28-29. Consider these things, how unsuitable to your profession of religion. So also for stripes, they do not become those who should be cemented with the same blood of Christ. All stripes are bad. Your heart was never the better when you came from them, but envious stripes are worst of all, and yet usually this is the sum of our contests. Who shall be greatest? Opinions are drawn in from the greater gloss and varnish. As Paul said, some preached gospel out of envy, Philippians 1:15, but usually that is the main quarrel, and so religion, which is the best thing, is made to serve the vilest affection. Observation 4, envy and strife go often under the mask of zeal. These were apt to glory in their carnal strifes. It is easy to take on a pretense of religion and to baptize envious contests with a glorious name. One faction at Corinth entitled their sect by the name of Christ, "I am of Christ," 1 Corinthians 1:12. They are reckoned among the rest of the factions. "I am of Christ," in the apostles' sense, is as bad as "I am of Paul," and I am of Apollos, and "I am of Cephas." Well then, examine those affections that are drawn forth under a disguise of religion. There may be zeal in the pretense, and bitter envy at the bottom, or in the foundation of it. Sin is often arrayed in the garment of virtue, and there are so many things that look like zeal, but are not. And our own interest is often concerned in the interests of religion that we have need to suspect ourselves, lest the wild gourds of frowardness and passion be mistaken for the planting of the Lord, zeal and righteousness. There are two shrewd presumptions upon which, if you cannot absolutely condemn such notions, you have cause to suspect them. One is, when they boil up into irregular and strange actions, true zeal, though it increase the stream, does not usually overflow the banks and break one rule to vindicate another. The other is, when we are apt to glory and boast, as in this place, in James here we're talking about, we usually boast of graces of our own making. 2 Kings 10, verse 16, "Come and see my zeal for the Lord of hosts," was in effect, but "come and discern my pride and hypocrisy." Hypocrites have so little of the power of religion that they adore their own form. And observation number 5, hypocrisy and carnal pretenses are the worst kind of lies, as to not tell the truth. The Lord complains, "They compass me about with lies." The practical lie is worst of all. By other lies we deny the truth, by this we abuse it. And it is worse sometimes to abuse an enemy than to destroy him. It had been more mercy in Tamerlane to have executed Bajazet than to have carried him up and down in scorn as his footstool. Hypocrites do not only feign against religion, but carry it up and down as a footstool upon which they step into their own interests and advancement. The practical lie is little better than blasphemy. Revelation 2:9. I know the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews and are not. It is a lie against the truth, indeed, and a blasphemy when we entitle it to our unclean intents. All right, and that is the end of verse 14. And we'll go ahead and stop there. And Lord willing, go on the next time. But until then, go seeking God to keep your heart clear of whatever might be ungodly in there, envying and strifes, and seeking the good of others out of love to God. And may we all do that and continually pray that. And Lord willing, we'll talk to you again soon.